Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to Captain M. H. Moyes. His talk was called With Mawson to the Antarctic, and was his first-hand account by one of the surviving members of the expedition to the Antarctic in 1913. It was recorded on the 2nd of August, 1974, and duration is 1 hour and 8 minutes.
I usually like talking in the Antarctic with slides, but years ago I realised my eyesight was going and I couldn't see them myself. So I gave them to the Mitchell Library. And it isn't easy to explain the Antarctic without slides, but I hope I can. I'd like first to tell you the history of it, which most people don't know is really very interesting. I often wish I was a writer, which I'm not, to write the history. You see, it goes back 500 or 600 years before the Christian era, the time when people thought the earth was flat. But a lot of Greek philosophers, they lot of clever men they had in those days, they looked round at everything else that was, the way the little pole star went round, and the sun and the moon and the stars and the seasons, and they said everything's symmetrical, and so the earth must be symmetrical too. It had to be a sphere. And then they thought, now then, if it's a sphere, then there must be a lot of earth down south, like there is up north. They thought no one would ever be able to see it. They wouldn't be able to go through the tropics. But anyway, as geographers got to work making maps, century after century, they all put a big mass of land down in the southern hemisphere. They called it the Terra Australis. And they used to put on it not yet known. And it seems strange that that went on for nearly 2,000 years. And then it largely came to change because the Portuguese, great trading people, and they wanted to trade with India and couldn't go overland because of the Turks. And they had probably the best seamen in the world then, because the head of Portugal, Prince Henry, had started a naval college to train seamen, and they got busy. And of course, everybody knows the name of one of them, Vasco da Gama, who said he'd dare that tropics, and he went down, he sailed down the coast of Africa, round to India. Not only made a trade route, but he also was the first man to prove that this Terra Australis didn't come up as far as they thought. Well then, 20 years afterwards, another Portuguese, Magellan, they'd gone across the Atlantic and found Brazil, and he got the King of Spain to give him a couple of ships. It took him a year to sail down the coast of Africa, of America, to finally get through to Magellan Strait. And of course the ship went across the Pacific, and Magellan died in the Malay archipelago, but one ship, strangely enough, we think the English name of Victoria, sailed through the Indian Ocean, round the Cape and back to Portugal. That is, it put a girdle round the earth to show that the Terra Australis didn't reach out that far. Although when they published another map, a very famous map, 20 years later, Orontius, a man, the geographer, he still put Terra del Fuego in the map. That is, this grand Terra Australis still reached up right to the foot of America. Well, in the next 200 or 300 years, seamen got busy in the south. We hear a lot about it, but at those days, so many things were placed wrongly because they couldn't find longitude, that we don't know many things accurately. But nearly every discovery they made was considered to be part of this terra australis, the southern land, such as when the Spaniards got New Guinea, that was an outpost of the southern land. And when Tasman got New Zealand, same thing, part of the southern land. So that even as late as 1760, there were still maps showing this enormous, nearly half of the southern hemisphere as a continent. Well, then we know that our old friend Captain Cook came on the scene. When he was sent out with the scientific party to Tahiti to watch the time when the planet Venus went across the sun's disk, he took them there, and then he came southwards on exploration, they called it. Well, as we know, he went round New Zealand and proved it wasn't a part of the big land. And then going on to Tasmania, have a look at it, as we know, he was blown up, saw the Australian coast, and followed up and found our east coast of Australia and went back to England. But he wasn't happy about the other, so he kept trying to get down to south, and finally they gave him two ships again. And his instructions were to discover this southern land or to prove it doesn't exist. Well, he didn't do either. But he came south, went to Cape Town and refitted, and then he started, and he went the first man who ever dared to go down into the ice. And he went straight down into the ice belt around the continent and came round eastwards. That was in the Christmas or summer season of 72. And he did about a third of it. And then as the winter came on, he went up to the Pacific to give his sailors a rest, came back later in the year and went round again. And this time, about August 1774, he was down south still in the southern. It's interesting to me that the newspapers have never mentioned Captain Cook since our own centenary, you might call it, 3 years ago. But he's been down there doing the greatest voyage in the world, I think. Anyway, in 74, he finally did the whole third of the continent, and he circumnavigated the world down at about latitude 60 degrees. Therefore, he proved that all these islands and things that had been called part of the southern land were incorrect. As I say, he didn't find it. He was the first man to ever go across the Antarctic Circle. That is the about 66 and a half degrees south, and that is really, geographers would call it the meridian or the zone between the frigid and the temperate zones. Well, it was a wonderful trip. So say he found nothing. In fact, when he gave his report to the Admiralty, he said that there might be land there, but if there is, anybody can have it as far as I'm concerned. That's what his words were. Anyway, about 50 years afterwards, the Russians sent an expedition down, and they also circumnavigated, and they didn't find land, but they did find an island inside the Antarctic Circle. They're the first nation to do that in 1719. But shortly after that, we began to open up, because Cook had reported the number of whales and seals down there. Now, there's seven or eight types of seals, the sea lion, the elephant, the sea leopard, sea bear, crab eater, Weddell seal, a lot of them. But only one of them, that is a sea bear, is any value. That is usually called the fur seal. The others are all hair seals. But so many sealers came out that they nearly cleaned out all the fur seals around the Antarctic. In fact, even now, there's only two islands where you can find the fur seals, but of course they are protected now. But the fact is, the sealers came out, and dodging round with their little ships, they started to open up. And in 1830, one of them, Captain Biscoe, he wrote back that he had seen a part of a continent. He'd seen a big white cliff like the cliffs of Dover, he said, and behind it a very high mountain. Well, that was called Enderby Land. Then, 10 years later, the England, France and America all sent expeditions down to look for the magnetic South Pole. Well, they didn't find it. It happens to be inland, of course. But the French saw some land in the distance. They couldn't get near it through the ice pack. They called it Adélie Land. The Americans came down a few weeks later. They saw Adélie Land too, but they moved along westwards and reported appearance of land in about 6 or 7 places. And incidentally, we went south of it in the Morton's expedition and they weren't there. Then nothing more happened till 2 years later when the English expedition went down. And the captain, Captain Ross, knowing that the French and Americans hadn't got through, he went down further to the east and managed to get through the ice pack. It happens to be a place where you can always get through the ice pack down there. And there he saw a big high headland where a coast turned southwards. And he sailed down south for 400 miles along that coast. It must be one of the most wonderful sights in the world. Because just inside from that coast going southwards, there is what they call the Admiralty Range, with mountain peaks 10, 12,000 feet high. All ice, of course, except the tops, which are too steep for snow to stay on. And down at the 400 miles end, there was an island, which he called Ross Island. He seemed to have been fond of naming things after himself. And beyond that, though, he couldn't get any further because right across from east to west was stopped was a big ice barrier. That's called the Ross Ice Shelf. Now that ice barrier is about 100 feet above sea level. That means that as much of it's floated, it's 1,000 feet thick and it's about 400 miles square, if you can think of that block of ice. Well, anyway, that was all the Ross Sea. Now to go on from there till 1899, that's another 60 years, the German expedition, scientific expedition, was down there, and it, at one place, was caught in the ice pack and was held there for a year. But as it drifted with the ice pack, they saw some land in the distance and sent a party across. The ice was so solid, and found some land, and they called it Kaiser Wilhelm Land. And I'm telling that because in 1900, when they started the agitation for Captain Cook's expedition, from all the coastline, round from what I call latitude 60, you see, right round the world, but that is a circle of 12,000 miles. Now, of all that, the only places were known are that Enderby Land, Adélie Land, Kaiser Wilhelm Land, and this Ross Sea. That's all that was known. Four places, you might say, about 1,500 miles apart. And so that's when Captain Scott was sent down in the Discovery Expedition. Well, naturally, he went to the Ross Sea area, as it was known, and that's where they spent that first 2 years, looking round on that large ice shelf and looking at the mountains. Now, from his expedition, of course, in his expedition there was a reserve lieutenant called Shackleton, who incidentally had to be invalided home with scurvy. But when he was well, he got up his expedition to go to the South Pole. A fantastic trip. Shackleton, you know, is greatly underrated. He was a very wonderful man. Perhaps it's because I know him really personally, because later on I was cabin mate with him for about 3 months when he went down again. Anyway, with his expedition, we had two Australians, Professor Edgeworth David and Dr. Mawson, and that led, of course, to them thinking that Australia should be in the picture, and they started the Mawson expedition. Now, I want to go back because I want to tell about my party was asked to do what I did down there. And so I want to go back to that first Scott expedition. It's very hard to explain it really to you, but I told you about an island down there and how it was stopped. That island, just beyond it, was this big 400 mile big ice ship, big barrier, 100 feet above sea level, the ice. Well, when Scott went down there, he built his hut in the southern part of the island, just near where it met that big ice barrier. And he wanted to see what the barrier was like, what was like the other side of the island. You couldn't see much because near where he built his hut was one of the three big mountains on the island, Mount Erebus, 13,500 feet high and still active. It's a wonderful sight, see this big, almost conical big white mountain, 13,000 feet high, and steam just coming out of the top all day long. Anyway, he hurt his knee and couldn't go when the day was arrived, so it went over four officers and eight men in the charge of Lieutenant Royds. And they had to cross from where they had to cross this island, or about 5 miles, to get onto the ice shelf. And they did that all right. It's rocky and icy in most places, but not very difficult. So they got on, and then they turned east to go along this ice shelf to see what it was like. And about 2 days they had a good run, and then it got to snow so heavily, and they came to a patch where the snow was about 2 feet deep, the soft snow on the ice of the ice shelf. You can't put a sledge through that. So Royd said, well, we've got three pairs of snowshoes here, so three of us will go on and have a look, and the other officer, Lieutenant Barn, take the men back to the ship. So they start to go back, and also they had good weather for a couple of days, but just before they got near the place where they had to go across the island again to get to the hut, began to snow heavily and the wind started up. And so finally he thought he saw a place which would do to start to go back to the hut, a big rock. He got in the shelter of that and he said, well, we'll have some meal before we start the march across. But there they started their bad luck, because they didn't know much about primer stoves in those days, or some of these lads didn't, because when they went out they only took one pricker with them. And anybody, if any of you have used a primer, you know that pricker is a pretty fragile thing. Anyway, it had broken, so they couldn't light the stove, so they couldn't have any meat or even make a cup of tea. So anyway, then Barnes said, well, now I can see that through the snow drift there's a lot of ice just there, so you better take off your fur shoes, which they'd all been wearing, and put on boots, because the fur shoes of course helped us on the ice. Well, they moved to boots, but two of the men couldn't put their boots on. They'd been issued with them the day before, they hadn't tried them, and now they couldn't get them on, two of them. One of them, named Frank Wilde, he had tried his when he was issued the day before, or the day before they left, and seeing a big bag of little spikes in the box too, he thought, oh well, they're supposed to be put in these, so he'd spiked his boots. Anyway, they had to set off. It was now snowing so thickly they couldn't see one another, so Barnes said, well, now touch one another as you go along. They'd gone a couple of hundred yards when Barn realized that the man who should have been next to him wasn't there. So he told him to wait while he kind of walked back and peered at the ground and found that there'd been a slope, and this other man slipped down that slope. So he said to them, well, stay there while I go down. So he sat down and slid down the slope to see what was down there, how the man was. He'd been waiting 2 or 3 minutes. Another chap said, well, he may be, that first man's hurt, may take two of us, so he sat down and slid down too. In the meantime, hare, one of the men who couldn't get his boots on, he thought, well, here's a chance for me to go back and try again. So he went back to where they'd left their sledge and stores, and he still couldn't get a pair of boots on, so he crawled up under a rock and went off to sleep. Now that left five of them, and after waiting for a while, they said, we better go on. So they went on in the direction that Barn had started, and they were going slowly up ice or slope. They got to the top. They couldn't realise, they didn't know, of course, the place, that they were on the lower slopes of Mount Erebus, the volcano. And so they got to the round there, round the slopes, and then suddenly it started to go down. And Frank Wilde, with the spiked boots, was in front and the head of the others, and suddenly he called out the loud voice, stop, because the drifting snow that comes out in kind of waves, and it had thinned out for a while, and he saw that just in front of him was a big cliff, and he could see 80 feet below the waters of the what they call McMurdo Sound. Well, they all stopped except the man who had the fur boots on, Abel Seaman Vince. He couldn't, it was too slippery on the ice, and he just couldn't stop. And the others through the mist saw him go tumbling down, and with a scream he died and slipped over the cliff down into 80 feet into the ice below. Well, then Wilde said, don't move. And he, as you can realise, if you can think of a roof of a house, a straight, not corrugated iron, but flat iron and very slippery, and you were standing up on the top of that, think how difficult it would be to turn around if it's so slippery. It's really impossible. And yet they had to turn round to go up the slope. So Wilde moved across to the man he could see dimly in the snowdrift. And there he bent down with his sheath knife. He hacked away at the ice until he made a flat place. And he helped the man to turn round, and then foot by foot, dug out foot step places all the way up till they got to the rock at the top. Now, if you realise that every time he bent down, he might have slipped, even with small spikes in his boots. And if he had, nothing could have saved him from going over the side. And yet he did that for the three men, one after the other. For half an hour, he just risked his life and got them to the top. In the meantime, when he'd seen the cliff, he'd noticed the way it ran, and so he knew where the hut must be, so he now took the men back. Now, that was man called Frank Wiley, able seaman. And he showed himself the same all that trip with Scott, did so well that when Shackleton 4 years later did his expedition to go to the pole, Frank Wilde was one of the men he picked to go with him. And once more he proved himself. And then we come on, of course, to Mawson. Because it was 4 years later when Mawson and David decided that Australia ought to be in this, their nearest country, and they got the government to support them, and a lot of people too, and they arranged this expedition, Australasian Antarctic Expedition it was called. And but now Mawson wasn't looking for the pole. All these other expeditions, Scott, Shackleton, Amundsen, had gone from this Ross Island to go to the pole. But Mawson was a scientist, and he wanted to prove things, and one of them was, is this an Antarctic continent? Is it a continent, or is it a lot of islands? And one of the best ways to do that was to see if there was a long coastline. Now then, he had realised he wasn't going to be into the Ross Sea. He wanted to come out and find out something new. So the only place he could come out to get, of course, was Adelie Land. It was the only place definitely known, except you might say Kaiser Wilhelm Land, 1,500 miles away, and Enderby Land another 1,500 miles. But Adelie Land was really pretty well south of Australia, so they picked that for his base. Now, he wanted to see if there's a coastline, so he thought he'd have two bases. The first time that had ever been thought of, called linked bases. If he had another base about 500 miles away from Adelieland, and that from each base men sledged 250 miles each way, you could find out if they could do it, it meant there was a coastline of 1,000 miles, which would tend to make some idea that there was a continent there. That meant that he had to have a leader for another base, so the man he asked to come was Frank Wyatt. So when the ship went down, at first, as the Aurora, it first landed a party of Wireless men at Macquarie Island, and then went straight down to Adelieland. And there Mawson landed with two huts and 18 men to headquarters. And then the ship was to go on with Frank Weil and seven men. That was the smallest party you can use in the Antarctic, really, because that means three men to go east and three to go west and two to remain at the hut. So anyway, that was left. And so Frank and these seven men, I was one of the seven men, yeah? And we were to go on and try and find a base about 500 miles away and in a place where the Americans had said appearance of land. Well, there was no land there. We were sailing 100 miles further south than the American fleet had been. There was no sight of land. In fact, as far as we could see to the south, there was ice, and there was what they call an ice blink on the horizon, a glare where the sun had hit the ice and reflected. And we won. I never forget that, because we went on week after week pushing the Aurora every time there was a bit of a gap in the ice pack, pushing it through. And perhaps go 10 miles and find she couldn't go any further, had to come out again. And then the blizzard would come on and we'd go out further out and shelter behind an iceberg for 2 or 3 days and then go back and start again. And we'd gone about 1,200 miles from Mawson's base when the Captain Davis said, well, we're going back to Australia. You can imagine how we all felt. And then the blizzard came on and we were sheltering among a very big iceberg. And the last 2 or 3 days had been very dull. We hadn't been able to see any distance. But when this blizzard stopped and we came out from that iceberg, there to the south there was a wonderful sight. There was nothing but undulating white slopes going away back towards the pole. Oh, we thought this is lovely. So we trailed off towards it, and then when we got there we couldn't get near it. And it was a funny position there. There was an ice shelf, like that ice shelf in the Ross Sea. But this one was sticking straight out from the land, an ice shelf about 150 miles square, and like the other one, 1,000 feet thick. Well, but between, in that corner where it stuck out from the ice shelf and the land, there was so much what we call ordinary ice pack, the ship couldn't get through. The ice packs, big lumps of ice floe that's broken up and parts of icebergs and so on. And we couldn't get within 15 miles of it. But Frank Weil went for a walk. There was still a bit of ice floe attached to the side of this ice shelf. And so Frank Weil went out for a walk with a couple of chaps, and on there he dropped off of the, we were tied up against the ice floe that was there. And he came back about half an hour afterwards with the lads, and they came in and they took two floorboards that were to have been part of the flooring of the hut which was to be built. And they went off and shore with those. And I had it here somewhere, I don't know whether it's here. Some of them might be able to see it. The rather dark one. That's one I'd like you to see afterwards. There was an enormous drift from the ice. This is the ice out here, 100 feet high. And there's been a big snow drift come over for some reason or other. It's been going on for so many years, but now it is 80 feet high. So Frank Weil got these two planks, carried them up to the top of that, that had just reached to the top of the ice shelf. And so he climbed up and got onto the ice shelf, and he walked around and he came back to the ship and told us the rest of us about this. He said, are you willing to take the risk? And he said, we'd rather do that and come back to Australia. So we said, yes. So that was all the captain. Who, of course, the second in command of the expedition. And Captain Davis wouldn't agree with the call. He said, no, it's too dangerous. Set ourselves afloat. And he pointed out to see a mile or two away where there were many icebergs which had definitely come off his ice shelf. But anyway, Wild kept at it. And finally, Captain Davis consented to go and chin up those things and go onto the ice shelf. And finally he said that he would agree that Frank Wild knew more about ice on the land than he did, and so he would definitely party land there. There was a bit in the paper a week or two ago, an article about Morse and the Ice Hero. Incidentally, a very disappointing article. Anyway, it mentioned how when Captain Davis had come to pick up that party, he had said, when we wished him good luck, he said, well, you'd better wish him good luck to get home, because if you don't, he said, you'll be there the rest of your life. See, the point is, these Aurora didn't have any sending wires. So we were 1,000 miles from where we were supposed to be. Anyway, we landed there, and there's so very few men except a man like Frank Wild would have ever thought of doing that and making that place. Well, we landed there, built our hut, and were there for a year, and the new land we discovered was called Queen Mary Land, and altogether we charted about 400 miles of new land. And of course the geologists and biologists did a bit of work too. Incidentally, that 400 was very useful, because a man in England who wrote a big book called Antarctic on these, what he called the Great Expeditions, he showed how Morton's expedition, the one expedition, had discovered more new land than Scott or Shackleton, who had two expeditions each. Because Morton himself had done 1,200 miles and we did over 400, so we fell altogether. Morton's expedition did 1,600 miles of new land. Well, that was our expedition. I was told I must tell my story, so I better tell it. It's rather amusing in a way. In the September, now I was, and Harrison, I was meteorologist and Harrison was biologist, and we were the two who must of course stay at the hut where our job was going to be. So during the year we did as much sledging as we could, knowing we were to be left when the big summer sledging time came on. Well, we went out in late September, went east to place a depot about 100 miles out, which would help the eastern party when they did their big summer trip. And we went out, we were 17 miles from the land on this ice shelf. So just by going a bit south of east, instead of going east, go south, we'd meet the land, coast of the continent, about 100 miles out. So we did that. And when we got near it, we saw a big black object. It turned out to be a big rock protruding from the ice shelf, or about 400 yards long and wide and a few hundred feet high. So Wild said, well, this will be the place, a good place to put our depot. So we dug a big trench in the ice with our ice picks, and in this we stood up a sledge and then filled it in the trench with snow and hard snow and ice, and near it we made another cache of the paraffin for the primary stove, and food, 6 weeks' food. So the party, when it came out, would have all that far out from the hut, help them. Then he wanted to come home. The two of the men wanted to stay there, One of them, you know, in all the way of Admiral Dover, his father, George Dover, was our surveyor, very conscientious, and he said, "Now I want to stop here, I want to fix this position before we go away." And the other geologist, he'd seen a bit of rock under the ice cliffs, and that's the first rock we'd seen for 8 months, so he wanted to try out his hammer on it. The wild said, "All right." So we moved in close to the land, about 400 yards from the land, and then we pitched our tents, and we no sooner got our two tents up than down they went. I've never known such a gust of wind, all very fierce. So we erected them again. Now the tents, there's really five bamboos joined together at the top, and the tent drops over those, and then a flap goes out about 2 feet on all round. And so you cover that up with blocks of snow and ice that should hold it against any blizzard, which it usually does. But this time, out they went. So anyway, we put them up again, and it was getting pretty late by the time that came on, so we said, "Oh, well, we'd better turn in." So we went right into our tents and had our dinner and got into our sleeping bags. And we hadn't been there very long, where there was a terrible noise. Now, we'd never heard an avalanche before. We knew what it was, though. There was thump, thump, thump all around us. And so we hastily got out. It was dark and it was snowing, and we couldn't see a thing. We all got out, the six of us and the two tents, and ran away from the coast. Well, we stood there for about 10 minutes. We could do nothing else, nothing but go back to our tents. So we did. And we got in our sleeping bags and probably enough and hoped for the best. And in the morning, there were big blocks of ice. Lucky they hadn't reached as far as our tents, but they were just big blocks of ice as big as this room here, before them come off the cliff and come down. Anyway, as we got out, the snow had stopped, but up come these gusts again. And one gust brought the barbers of Harrison. He'd blown clean over. Now, when I was in a tent with Dover and Wild, and when I saw Wild put on spiked boots that morning, I put on spiked boots, luckily. And so he and I chased after Harrison and managed to catch him and bring him back, because he helped us with those fur boots on. Well, we just got him back when the gust came, and one of the tents just split in the top and fell straight down. I can see Dr. Jones now, he was the cook for the morning, and there he was on his knees pumping up the primers, and the tent had gone over. Well, we got to work, we all got into the other tent now and got our breakfast, but then what to do? We could never get that tent up again. We were frightened ours might go too. So Wild said, "Well, the only thing is to do is to live underground." So we set to work. It was very nasty, windy and snowy. We all ran trying it with our ice axes. We couldn't find anywhere a surface which was more than 2 or 3 inches of snow. Straight ice underneath that. Until one man called out he had it. So he dashed over and there he was. It was another risk we had to take, because the place he'd found was soft snow with it. A filled in crevasse. We weren't sure that it's been filled in all the way down. At any rate, the only thing we could do, so we dug a hole there with our ice axes and the spades, about 12 feet by 8 and 3 feet deep. And then we threw our sleeping bags and our foods and everything else into it. And then we laid the good tent across the top and anchored it down with our two sledges and fixed them down with ice axes and brought our dog team and put them nearby, and we crawled in the little hole where you get into the tent, and there we were. And there we stayed for 5 days. And after one day, our clothes, you could have wrung them out, because we had to lie in our sleeping bags all day. Well, of course, the warmth from them got through to the snow underneath. And we had to light the primers occasionally to get a drink or to make our meals, and of course, the snow on the top had melted and run through the canvas, and it was miracle. But all the same, I can look back on the time, because it was a rather happy gathering. I don't think there were many hymns that we missed in the between the six of us. And of course, Frank Wilde and Noel Salley knew every sea shanty there was. And of course, the grand opera, we had a gramophone in the hut, and we'd have it in the ship. And we only have about 20 records, so we knew those off backwards by now. And so those 5 days went fairly quickly. But when we got out after 5 days, oh, it was bad, because our sleeping bags were so sodden that when we got out and the temperature dropped to 30 below, and we were travelling home, well, that, of course, the fur, the inside of the bags, the top and the bottom, froze together. So when the first thing, when we stopped at midday, we had to take off most of our clothes and shake them off, because inside was now frost, because they'd been soaked through, and now they'd all, that water was frozen, and we could take off the frost from all in our clothes. And at night time, we couldn't get into the sleeping bags even. We had our knives and cut our way into the ice. We were glad to get home that time. Well, that's a prelude to tell you my story, my incident. When the time came for the final trips, the three to go the east, the three to go west, Charlie Harrison, who was the biologist, like me, he had to stay at the hut. But there's nothing for him to do, because the sea was still frozen out as far as the eye can see. So there are no herds or animals anywhere. So he suggested, could he take the little dog team, which was going to the left of us, and help this party out 100 miles to the east across the ice shelf? Wilde asked me, and I said, oh no, I don't mind. So Wilde said, oh well, don't forget you mustn't go away more than 100 yards from the hut. That was the rule in the Antarctic, you mustn't go by yourself, you see. So there might be a crevasse, you never knew where it was. So I said, all right, so off they went. The other party wasn't to leave till another 3 days, so I expected that Harrison would be back in another couple of days, because by the time he'd gone out there and emptied his sledge, and he was bringing the dog team back, he could sit on the sledge and just come back very quickly. Probably take 3 days instead of a week. Well, anyway, so that's what happened. But he didn't get back. Day after day, I looked around and no sign of Harry. When he'd been away for 7 or 8 days, I knew he didn't have much more food. Couldn't have. I knew there was a lot of crevasses about 30 miles out. We found them when I did the first trip with him. So I wandered out there and carried on the sledge marks, of course, still remain on the ice, because the weight going over the soft snow surface, kind of salt makes that solid. So when the wind comes and blows a loose snow, and you can leave these tracks for quite a few weeks. Well, I went over and had a look and went down along the crevasses, no sign. I came back, nothing more I could do. And so nothing else I could think was that the whole ford had gone out of crevasse somewhere. Particularly as I know there were two or three nasty ones we'd seen. Well, the fact is I stayed there then for nearly 10 weeks on my own. And then one day I was in the hut, I thought myself a young dippy at last. Walking around on tiptoe so I wouldn't make any noise. You can't imagine the size of the Antarctic. As a matter of fact, you can't. Two years ago, that rival Thomas Kennedy went down. And when he came back, he went down to a place in the Ross Sea, and he went for a walk by himself. And he said he could never realize that silence could be around the life of things. Well, it is, it's a dreadful thing. So there's no birds, no anything to speak to, and except for the heavy blizzard, there's nothing, not a sound. And he's really walking on creaking floorboards in the house. It's a terrible noise to make. Anyway, then one day I said, you're going to be now, I heard music. So I went out and rushed around the house, and there I saw a team coming along. And I looked at them, there were four in it. Martin must be wild steam with Harrison. I tell you, it's a very happy moment. The point would be that when they got out to where we'd buried that sledge and the fuel, 100 miles out, we'd usually the stuff solidifies, but we'd gone in and had that very heavy gust of wind, and that heavy gust must have got that sledge before it got fixed into the ice and snow and blown away. So when Ward's party went out there, there was their big cache of food, 6 weeks' food, and no sledge. Now they had to have another sledge for this food to go on with the big hub. That's the main work of the Antarctic, that summer trip. So the only thing to do was to take Harrison with them. And so that's what happened. Harrison had to go, and thank God he had to leave me alone. There's nothing else for it. So that was that trip. Now the next trip I had, I must say the next two trips I went, I never thought of going really. The next one was at the end of 1916. And some of you may know how Shackleton was going to cross the Antarctic continent. He was going to go into a bay on the other side, the American side, go to the pole and come straight through back to the Ross Sea, this side. Take a party which would lay depots towards the pole over this big ice shelf down there. So when Shackleton got to the pole and came back, he could pick them up. He wouldn't have to carry all the food all of their cost. Just like Hillary did for Fuchs some years later. Well, they got down there this time in the Aurora, and the first summer, that's the summer of 14, they got there pretty late, but they did lay in good depots there, and depots out for about 70 miles. And the Aurora went back to tie up along the Ross Island and right for the winter. And then early in May, this place, this island, was about 20 miles away from the coastline here, and in between, they called that McMurdo Sound, and it used to freeze over solidly, so that when you weren't in any place on the side of the island, the other part, you can't get on the island, you have to walk down over the ice. Well, anyway, they'd have to live at Cape Evans. That's where Captain Scott made his hut on the second time he went down, which was 15 miles from where he had his first hut, and all in between that was frozen over, solid with ice. But this night, in early May, a big storm came up, and it drew the whole of that ice out of that river, around 15 miles away. It took the Aurora away from the moorings, broken the rudder, took it right out. And there were 10 men left in the hut. And of course, when they came out in the morning, there was no ship. And also, there was no crew. The ship, expecting to be there all the time, hadn't landed the supplies they had laid out for the hull to Shackleton. And hadn't had anything else, none of their personal belongings. They had the only personal boat they stood up in. And plenty of steady food for the sort, but nothing like soap or tobacco or cakes or anything like that. And they were left there. Anyway, what happened was that the Aurora drifted in the ice pack for 10 months. And then when she was smitten, the knot she was tied up in drifted toward the edge. She got out and eventually fixed up the rudder and sailed back to Dunedin. And there was the first time that people reported what happened from the Shackleton expedition. So this was April of 16, or May of 16, and then gone since August 14. In the meantime, the British government had asked the Australian government to do something about it. And so when the ship arrived back at Dunedin, the British government asked the New Zealand government to refit it, and asked the Australian government to send down an expedition to look for these 10 men. And Captain J.K. Davis, probably the most experienced of Antarctic men, skippers were there, he was running a transport at the time, so he was asked to see the expedition. And now it wasn't known where that 10 men might be.
they might have gone out, trying to those depots, might be lost, something might happen. So they wanted somebody with special experience and somebody who could navigate on the ice for no traffic lights and things. And so David asked the chairman of the committee for me. Chairman's committee happened to be across the first naval member, representing England. So I was deposited to go down and take them to a search. As a matter of fact, I wasn't really interested because I was over there to the place where the influenza came from, Port Charman, where the Royal was refitted, and had everything ready to go down, and who should arrive at Shackleton. He, any of you know his story, that most wonderful trip he did across the southern seas in a boat 750 miles in the worst seas of the world, and then climb over mountains 10,000 feet high as never been climbed before. All the time he'd been living on chocolate and biscuits. This is one of the things. And then he got a trawler. First he had to go around and rescue 2 minutes. That's on the other side of the island, one of the broken legs. And then he had to get to Argentine and get a ship to go down to help him rescue a 30 minute left on a dreadful rock called Elephant Island, knowing that they could never live over on it. And the ship got halfway and then refused to go any further, it was too cold. So he went down to Chile. And there he got another ship. And they were going to mutiny too, but his power shackling was too strong, and he managed to get them to go right down and rescue these men from Elephant Island. Got back to Chile, went up and caught a boat and came over. So arrived at Dunedin just a week before we were sailing. And I shared a cabin with him for several months there. So we went down and found that the 10 men, 3 were dead, but we brought the other 7 back. David and Deborah had done absolutely a wonderful job. Although the food that had been left for them to load these depots was still in the Aurora, they had gone round all these huts that were still down there, 2 of Scots and 1 of Shackleton, and went all round there, found a terrible old sledging crew. You see, this sledging crew called pemmican, it's no good bringing it back to Australia, it's useless. It was better if it was still around there. And with that, they had gone out, their clothes were falling to bits, their fur shoes, they had to make new shoes out of pony rugs. You know, Scott and Shackleton basically was ponies, as they call. Not as old pony rugs, but they made shoes out of those. They made trousers themselves out of a belt of canvas, and they made the deputy of Shackleton one. It was a very wonderful job. Now the third time I went down, once again I didn't know anything about it, but in telling of the history of the Antarctic, I told you how the first man down there in 1830 had seen this Enderby land in the distance. Now, for 100 years it had just been a little pink mark on the chart. Now I'm seeing it, now I'm moving on it, and anything else. But towards the end of the 20s, we Norwegians were going down south, and a little ship with a very wonderful man called Admiral Reza Larsen, and they were hoisting the flag at any untrained land. Now, if they got to the end of the land, they could have put up the flag that was there. So England asked the Australian government to arrange an expedition, and Morse, of course, was then great that he was still alive. And all I knew was that I got a signal from the committee saying you've been offered the position of the chairman of the expedition. I didn't know if I wanted to go or not, but everybody wanted to stop for a minute. There's no anything to go down there and be there to get into the end of the land and start the coast line. And be there when Morton raised the flag, when we land at last, and the time goes for the British government. This is, of course, now the western part of the Australian Antarctic Territory. Now, that's my 3 expeditions. I'd just like to tell you a story for yourself. On that last expedition, we England had caused them, Scotland discovered the expedition, and Captain Douglas was again the captain. He brought it out to Cape Town, and Sir Douglas Mawson, he took the size of his team of 12 altogether, and we went to Cape Town in the Nestor and picked up the discovery there. Well, when we boarded and left Cape Town and went down south, there was another scientist on board that didn't know anything about. One of the scientists had taken a little kitten off in his pocket. I'd never used a kitten. No one else used a kitten there. It was kept down in the forecastle, and it never came up the steps in the forecastle. But then we were down right on Antarctic water, and we'd had what we call a scientific station. That is, we'd stop, and we'd get more from all around the echo sounding machine. We'd ask them what depth, and I'd find the depth of the echo sounder. If I said 2,000 fathoms, but he'd say, right, we'll throw 1,800 fathoms. And then we'd put down bottles and thermometers and all sorts of things and keep bringing them up and down for the chemists and the biologists and so on. And at the end, we'd drop a trawl rather than trawl that along the bottom for half a mile, and then bring up the most evil things you've ever known in your life. I'm going to go through it. Anyway, we'd had one of those, and so everything had been cleaned up, and we were still just drifting. Hardly a move. It was a very calm sea. There was ice blocks around, but otherwise, very calm. And 3 or 4 inches down near the stern, and then suddenly the captain got tipping overboard. And there was a sailor nearby who'd seen it. He seemed to have seen it the first time. He decided it was an explorer at sea. So he came up the steps and walked across the house. And well, the wide rail was in trouble. And we're sitting there when and this side there must be 6 feet up there, but the ship was just moving, suddenly just hit a block of ice and goes, it was there, not the push of getting overboard, and they're expensive. And so he said, everybody else suddenly appeared, and it's nowhere. But there was nothing to look for. There were 2 boat looks about, but in a ship like the Discovery, yeah, there was never anything loose because it was about so much. And we were down the stern. We started looking around, and there was nothing anywhere to pick out. Now you could see this little black head out there struggling away in the water and getting a bit further away from ship every minute, you know, because very little ripple from the bows, you know, would come and then keep taking a little bit further out. So when it's getting down near us, it was really out of quite a reach of the boat. It's about 4, must have been about 4 yards out. And just we looked on helplessly, and suddenly there was a yell, and down the right down pipe, right down to us came a big figure dashing down. And as he got to us, he said, "Throw me a line." And he went and he jumped up on the side of the ship and fell flat out in the water, as he did so, holding out a hand and picked up a chipping like that. And in the meantime, of course, it being a sudden ship, there were plenty of rope ends about, so we threw 3 or 4 over to him, we threw one of those, and we hauled him in, he caught with the other hand, we still held him the kitten up, and as he got near the side, one of the sailors took the kitten from him and rushed away up for it, and we hauled him in, and his other mates rushed him up for it too, and gave him a good old paddling down. Well, we coiled down the ropes again, and went along, we knew where they'd be. We have an auxiliary engine there, a small engine room, and I'm in our full speed with it, steam down 6 knots. Looking down the skylight, I never forget it. There down there was a little box, which had been the kitten's place where it lived before they brought it up. There were blankets and things down there. It was all covered over, and you could see a little black head sticking out in the middle of it, and about a dozen big brawny sailors looking down at it. So I thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.